The headlines: Israeli forces killed 10 Palestinians in the occupied West Bank in the deadliest day of the regime violence in years. Iran censures some regional countries for using a fake name for the Persian Gulf, saying the move contravenes a principle of good neighborly relations. And the UK and Canada say they will send heavy tanks to Ukraine, following suit with similar decisions by the US and Germany.
Hello and welcome. Your world news coming to you live from our headquarters in Tehran. My name is Gisum Shahmadi.
There appears to be no end in sight to deadly crimes of Israelis against Palestinians. The regime forces have killed yet another Palestinian in the occupied West Bank. 22-year-old Yusuf Yahya was shot dead while participating in a protest against the Jenin refugee camp. His death brings the total number of those killed on Thursday by Israeli forces to 10, marking it the deadliest day of the new year. Israeli troops have barred medical teams from reaching the area. Regime forces also stormed hospitals in Jenin and internationally intentionally fired tear gas towards the pediatric department. Separately, Israeli forces demolished a sports club in the refugee camp. Palestinians have held the funeral for those recently killed by regime forces. The recent raid on the Jenin refugee camp comes a day after Israeli forces shot dead 2 Palestinians in separate attacks in the West Bank. 30 Palestinians have been killed in the occupied territories since the beginning of the year 2023. Political commentator Saad Nimer says the Palestinians need to unite under one flag to bolster resistance.
Yes, it is called massacre, nothing less than a massacre. What happened today, it's not only the 10 who was killed in Jenin, but also we have another one in Ram, and also a child in Gaza who was affected by raid earlier last year. Well, we have always ways to react, and we should understand the reaction. First thing first, the resistance. The resistance should continue and should be escalated against the Israeli, and they should know that they should pay the price for all crimes they are committing against the Palestinian people. This is the first thing. Secondly, and most importantly, I think, instead of going to plea to the international community, come and help us, we should help ourselves. Mahmoud Abbas, as a president, should declare today, not even tomorrow, that all Palestinian factions should be united and to end this separation between Gaza and West Bank, and to reunify all Palestinian factions under one general command in all of Palestine, West Bank and Gaza. And this will put the Israeli and put them in freak, definitely, and will make them really very angry. Thirdly, to have a kind of a strategy to know where are we going and what we are going to do, and what are our means of doing that. And definitely resisting the occupation and resisting this entity or this regime.
Reactions are pouring in from across Palestine over the Israeli regime's latest deadly raid on the Jenin refugee camp. Palestinian resistance group Islamic Jihad has condemned the atrocity. The Islamic Jihad and Hamas expressed readiness to fight back if the raid continues. The Palestinian presidency has weighed in on the matter, calling the aggression a, quote, organized massacre. It has urged the international community to intervene. The Palestinian Authority has also called on the international community to hold Israel accountable for its actions. Meanwhile, a spokesperson for the Palestinian president, Mahmoud Abbas, said the Palestinians ended security conditions with Israel following the raid. Iran has censured some regional countries for using a fake name for Persian Gulf, saying the move contravenes the principle of good neighborly relations. The foreign ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani made the remarks in reaction to the use of the fake name for Persian Gulf, saying that some Iranians in the foreign ministry have sent an official memo to the Iraqi state, describing the move unacceptable. Iran has stressed, the top Iranian diplomat, that the Persian Gulf has been known by this name for thousands of years, and in ancient history and documents, maps and televlogs also are the same. Kanani added that using such, quote, baseless words cannot change reality. He said that Iraqi officials should not try to win over the other countries, but and the friendship of them at the cost of historical solidarity among regional states. Earlier in our news review program, we took a closer look at Western hypocrisy when it comes to freedom of speech, with the Holy Quran being promoted in some European countries. The desecrating of it is being promoted. Let's take a listen.
It's time now for the news review of this bulletin. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi has condemned the desecration of the Holy Quran in European countries that claim to advocate human rights and freedom. Addressing a conference in Tehran, Raisi said the act of sacrilege was an insult to the entire Abrahamic religions. He said similar cases where desecration is done in the name of freedom of expression are, quote, the worst type of insult to humanity. The Iranian president said disrespecting the Quran or any divine religion is, quote, abhorrent act. This against the backdrop of burning and tearing apart of copies of the Holy Quran by two far-right politicians in Stockholm at The Hague. The sacrilegious acts have angered Muslims around the world. Masoud Shajar from the Islamic Human Rights Commission in London joins us. We also have Said Mohsen Abbas, who's a journalist and political commentator, also joining us from London. Welcome to you both, gentlemen. Said Mohsen Abbas, the people who might commit anti-Islam acts, which in this case have been unfortunately, the tearing apart of the Islam's holy book, the Quran, might not even be aware that the higher-ups perhaps are using them, that they're going ahead with this act, but they're indirectly contributing for the political motive of the higher-ups or higher echelons, which is to demonize Islam and to pretty much send out the message that, hey, Muslims, we're putting you on check. You don't think that you can elevate your status to where you'd like it to be. Is that a correct way of looking at this?
I think that's correct. Rasmus Paludin, who runs the hardline party, the Danish hardline party, he's been convicted for racism and defamation laws before. He's tried to burn a Quran before in a Muslim area, that time he was thwarted, I think. And he claims he's done a stunt to basically show his party's opposition to immigration and to stand up for free speech. I mean, what on earth has burning the holy book got to do with freedom of speech? You could find a million other ways to demonstrate your ire in terms of immigration. I mean, there's no connection. So clearly this chap, who was then given a license, literally given a license by the Swedish government to go ahead with this burning, I mean, with their blessing, the Swedish government essentially has sponsored a hate crime. They're hate mongering. They're inciting violence against Muslims in this way by having people freely being able to go around burn their books. And the next stage is, do you want to burn Muslims as well? You know, these are extremists who've been given a free rein under the cloak of freedom of expression, and the reality is that they would censor you for having ordinary opinions around anything from COVID through to climate change and even your views on Ukraine or Iranian rioters. I mean, these days you'll get censored in the West for any of these things. You could even be prosecuted, to be honest. But here, suddenly, they're very, very concerned about freedom of speech when it comes to, defaming Muslims and causing essentially a potential sort of a disorder situation. And this is something absolutely across Europe that is a trend that has been set. Sweden, though, isn't just guilty of hate crimes in terms of religion. They've already been pulled up by a UN Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination for basically being promoters of racist hate speech, you know, against Afro-Swedes, Jews, Muslims, and Romas as well. Their hate crime levels, it should be noted, are increasing. You know, year on year, they seem to go up many percentages, and it's a substantial amount of hate crime that's going on there in Sweden as well.
Well, you know, Master Shajari, I mean, my question is in no way trying to imply that violence needs to be used, but there's going to be some Muslims somewhere in the world who's going to get so offended by this act, and I'm not going to name a country because I don't want to vilify that country in a sense, but you're going to have Muslims that are going to get so offended that they may commit some kind of act against that goes against the national security of countries that are committing the acts. Isn't that something that the countries that are not really coming out and voicing against this act, jeopardizing their own security?
Well, I mean, it's quite clear that Muslims around the world, a quarter of the population, they're being bombarded day in, day out, that they are second-class citizens, they don't matter, their interest is undermined. They're being abused, they're being sort of abused day in, day out. Eventually, this sort of abuse against this such a large proportion of a community around the world, it's going to have consequences. There's definitely, that is how things operate. And, you know, I remember at the time of Salman Rushdie, when some Muslims actually in Britain and elsewhere were burning the satanic verses, we were being told clearly by the Westerners and Europeans that in their culture, burning a book resembles Nazism, and indeed burning a book means being against freedom of speech and freedom of expression. Now, Muslims are opposing the holy book of Muslims being burned. We are being told the exact opposite, that we are against freedom of speech, and burning the Quran is an expression of freedom of speech and freedom of expression. This is madness. This is sort of such a double standard, which is crazy. But nevertheless, the authorities, be it in Sweden or elsewhere, are not really waking up to their hypocrisy, and they're actually supporting this.
Thank you very much for that, Sayyid Mohsin Abbas, journalist and political commentator. Master Shajar, a pleasure. Islamic Human Rights Commission from London. Thank you to you both. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of the News Review. Thanks for tuning in.
The UK and Canada say they will send heavy tanks to Ukraine following similar decisions by the United States and Germany. The British government says it will spend 14 Challenger 2 tanks by the end of March. It added that training Ukrainian soldiers in how to use and maintain those tanks will start next week. Canada, for its part, said it will supply heavy tanks to Ukraine, starting with a shipment of 4 fully operational German Leopards. The new development came after Germany promised to provide Ukraine with its Leopard tanks by the end of March. Following Berlin's announcement, the U.S. said that it would send 31 Abrams tanks to bolster Ukraine in its war with the Russians. The British Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, hoped that London's decision would serve as a catalyst for other countries to follow suit. Russia has dismissed as, quote, provocation, a report by the UN nuclear watchdog about powerful explosions near Ukraine's Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant. The reaction came after head of the International Atomic Energy Agency claimed the vicinity of the plant had been rocked by 8 strong explosions. An advisor to the head of the company that operates Russia's nuclear plant, Rafael Grossi's comments were unfounded. Renat Kecha says Grossi's remarks were aimed at convincing a Western public opinion that Russia cannot uphold safety of the nuclear power plant. Zaporizhzhia is the largest nuclear power plant in Europe and among three of the largest Russian forces, power plants in the world. Russian forces took control of the plant soon after the Ukraine war started in February 24th. The U.S. president has called for protests to be peaceful after five police officers were charged in the death of a black man following a traffic stop. Joe Biden said the investigations show that people are outraged at the incident, adding that, however, the violence is never acceptable. He admitted that more steps must be taken to ensure that in the United States criminal system, as part of an impartial Biden remark, came after five officers charged with a second-degree murder over the death of 29-year-old Aaron Nicholas on January 7th. His family says Nicholas was so brutalized by police that he was completely unrecognizable. Nicholas was taken to the hospital in critical condition, where he died actually 3 days later. Police brutality against the people of color has been a major source of public outrage in the U.S. This issue has caused more strong reactions to the 2020 death of George Floyd. He was a 46-year-old black man who was murdered by police in Minneapolis.
And now with that, we come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
In the limelight.
Since the beginning of the Russia-Ukraine conflict, billions of dollars of military equipment and weapons have been poured into Ukraine by the West, especially the United States of America. Also, with prolongation of the war in Ukraine and the continuous aid of West to Kiev, Russia has repeatedly called the actions of Western countries criminal and the beginning of the Third World War. We take a look at some of the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The Reuters news agency has covered this story and tells us more. The United States has decided to take the Ukraine war to the next level by sending Kiev its much-sought Abrams tanks, despite Russia's warnings. Unnamed officials said on Tuesday, 24th of January, the U.S. is moving towards sending Abrams tanks to Ukraine. In a reversal from its previous policies, the United States appears to be dropping its opposition to sending M1 Abrams battle tanks to Ukraine. An announcement could be made over the next few days. Till now, Washington has said providing Ukraine with Abrams tanks is not feasible due to its difficult training and maintenance. Following the Ukraine Defense Contact Group in Ramstein, Germany, on Friday, 20th of January, Ukraine on Saturday, 21st of January, denounced the global indecision displayed by its allies in providing Kiev with advanced battle tanks, claiming, "Today's indecision is killing more of our people." Germany in particular faced a huge backlash from its NATO allies over its refusal to agree to send German-made Leopard tanks to Ukraine, amid unprecedented pressure mounting on Germany to do more to help Kiev. Western military leaders gathered in Ramstein Air Base in Germany to provide Kiev with billions of dollars worth of fresh military hardware. The new aid package includes armored vehicles and munitions for the Ukrainian forces who are fighting Russian troops. U.S.-made Bradley fighting vehicles, Stryker armored personnel carriers, mine-resistant ambush-protected vehicles, and high-mobility multipurpose wheeled vehicles, alongside tens of billions of dollars worth of armored vehicles made by other allies in addition to various military hardware, have been sent already to Ukraine since Russia launched its special operation in February of last year. Moscow has repeatedly warned Western countries against the futile attempt to stop Russia from reaching its objectives in pro-Russian regions of Ukraine. Moscow has warned the West flooding of weaponry to Kiev only prolongs the war and will add to the casualties. The English website of Al Jazeera channel has also covered this story and tells us more. Former Russian president and deputy chairman of the country's Security Council, Dmitry Medvedev, had said Russia was forced to launch its special operation in Ukraine to defend itself against the enemy's preparation of aggression. Dmitry Medvedev said on Monday, 23rd of January, "The special operation launched by Russia in Ukraine almost a year ago was Moscow's last resort response to preparations for aggression by the United States and its satellites." Medvedev said the world came really close to the threat of World War III as a result of the US-led NATO's expansionist policies in Eastern Europe. Dmitry Medvedev was addressing the leadership of the ruling United Russia Party in Moscow, explained to the audience, he said, "It is obvious that the world came close to the Third World War because of what was happening." Medvedev said at the meeting of the Bureau of the Supreme Party Council, "The task of our diplomacy is to prevent the cynical line of the Western countries," adding that Moscow's trustworthy partners are countries with significant global economic and political power. Prior to this, Medvedev had warned that the continuous request by Ukraine for the West to deliver bigger and bigger shipments of their most advanced military equipment to Kiev in order to defeat the Russian side could provoke the outbreak of a nuclear war. Medvedev went on to describe a serious crisis at the United Nations and other international institutions. He said, "The United Nations was created to resolve international disputes, however, it has been turned into a battlefield for the West." Medvedev said, "Our opponents are trying to enlist as many votes as possible in support of their anti-Russia initiatives, using underhanded means such as economic pressure, extortion, and political bribery." He added, "The main mission of Russian diplomacy remains to counter this cynical line by the West." Turkey's Anadolu news agency has also covered the same story and tells us more. A senior Russian official has warned that deliveries of offensive weapons to Ukraine by the United States and NATO for attack on Russia would lead to a global catastrophe. Vyacheslav Volodin, the chairman of the lower house of the Russian parliament, made the remark in a post on his Telegram channel on Sunday, 22nd of January, after Ukraine's allies recently promised Kiev a new military aid package worth billions of dollars. Vyacheslav Volodin said supplies of offensive weapons to Kiev would lead to a global disaster if Washington and NATO supply weapons that will be used to strike civilian cities, civilians in Russia and Russian cities and attempt to seize our territories as they threaten. This will lead to retaliatory measures using more powerful weapons. He said arguments that nuclear powers have not previously used weapons of mass destruction in local conflicts are untenable, stressing that those states did not face a situation where the security of their citizens or their territorial integrity was at stake. The senior Russian lawmaker, Vyacheslav Volodin, called on members of US Congress, members of Germany's Bundestag, France's Parliament, or France's National Assembly, and other European parliamentarians to realize that their responsibility to humankind, warning that they are pushing the world to a disastrous war by their decisions. Russia's Itatas news agency has also covered the same story. Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says the war in Ukraine is no longer a hybrid one, as it has almost escalated into a real one, with the West continuing to plot against Moscow. Sergei Lavrov said on Monday, 23rd of January, "When we speak about what is happening in Ukraine, it is a war, not a hybrid one, almost a real one, that the West has been plotting for a long time against Russia." Speaking at a press conference during a visit to South Africa, Sergei Lavrov said, "The goal is to destroy everything Russian, from language to culture. That has been in Ukraine for centuries, and to prohibit people from speaking their mother tongue." Sergei Lavrov said, "Any cultural contacts related to the Russian language are prohibited in Ukraine, and this is all supported by the West." The top diplomat made the remarks as European governments, including Poland, pushed Germany to give permission for supplying Kiev with German-made Leopard tanks. Sergei Lavrov also said Moscow was willing to negotiate with Kiev in the early months of the war, but that the United States and its Western allies advised the Ukrainian government against any negotiations with Moscow. Lavrov said by the end of March of 2022, delegations from both sides agreed on the principle to settle this conflict. He added, "It is well known and was published openly that our American, British and some European colleagues told Ukraine that it is too early to deal with Moscow, and the arrangement which was almost agreed was never revisited by the Kiev regime." However, the West claimed Russia was not serious about peace negotiations.
Food for thought.
Hello everyone, and here is some wonderful food for thought from Imam Ali al-Naghi al-Hadi, peace be upon him, the 10th infallible successor of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. "Better than the good deed is its doer. Nicer than nice utterance is the one who utters. More virtuous than knowledge is the one who has the knowledge. And worse than evil is the evil doer. And uglier than terror is the one who terrifies."
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday.
with you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, self-knowledge. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of self-knowledge in the Islamic lifestyle. Generally, when we talk about the Islamic lifestyle, we talk about different aspects of the life, how to deal with the people, how to socialize, how to live an Islamic lifestyle. But the most important thing is that before we think about others, we must know about ourselves. We must have a self-knowledge, and which is also recommended and preferred by Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wasalam in the Quran as well. Allah has emphasized on people to know about themselves. In one of the sayings, like Imam Ali alayhi salam has said that man arafa nafsahu faqad arafa rabbahu. Whoever knows himself, who gets the self-knowledge, he knows his Lord. So basically, knowing about our own selves takes us towards the knowledge of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, to know the purpose of existence. And when we know about ourselves, we can have a good Islamic lifestyle. We can live a pure Islamic lifestyle. Therefore, it is necessary to know about ourselves. Now, when we talk about knowing ourselves, generally it is assumed that knowing ourselves means to know about our cells, for example, what is my gender, what is my name, I have two eyes, I have a tongue, I have ears. So this is a general knowledge that we have about ourselves. But when it is said that we need to have a self-knowledge, it means we need to know about ourselves as knowing the nafs that we have, inshallah. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of self-knowledge in the Islamic lifestyle. We said that it is necessary to know about ourselves, and we say to know about ourselves, we mean we should know about the nafs that we have. For example, that why I was created, what potential did Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has given me, and what kind of potentials do I have? What kind of abilities do I have? How can I reach the perfection? And where do I stand? This is very important, because when we want to reach the perfection, we want to gain the perfection, we should know where we stand spiritually, where we stand, and materially where we stand. Because if I don't know about myself, if I do not know my nafs, then I cannot gain perfection in my life. Without knowing about myself, without knowing my status, without knowing where do I stand, how can I improve myself? And that is important, that we know about ourselves, we know what are the deficiencies that we have, in which area of life or in which area of the Islamic lifestyle I need to work. Therefore, this is very important that we know about ourselves, we spend some time to think about ourselves, that where do we stand? When Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said to be the Muslim or the slave, am I a true slave? Am I someone who is obedient to his parents? Am I performing my daily prayers on time? Am I avoiding all the forbidden things or not? Therefore, it is necessary to first analyze ourselves and have a self-knowledge in order to have a good Islamic lifestyle, insha'Allah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
News, social news, scientific news, artistic news, with delight.
Iran is the land of saffron, and the red gold has earned the country a fortune throughout the centuries. Now Iran's city of Torbat Haydariya has hosted a saffron photography festival as a means to introduce the lucrative product to the world. Yusuf Jalali reports.
Like gold, it is weighed in shekels, not in kilos. And that's why saffron is called the red gold, reflecting how precious it is economically. Torbat Haydariya in northeast Iran is the hub of saffron cultivation in the country, producing an average of 20 million tons of the crop each year. Now the city hosts the Festival of Saffron Photography every year to introduce Iran as the land of saffron and how these hard-working farmers produce the strategic crop.
Photographers present in this festival should use their artistry to shed light on different stages of saffron harvest all the way to the final product. Everyone knows Iranian saffron, but perhaps few know how it's produced. So this festival highlights this issue using photography.
Photography is a universal language that needs no translation, so their photos can better introduce this strategic plant to the world from unique angles.
This year, Iran exported roughly 300 tons of saffron, generating more than $350 million in income, according to the data provided by the Ministry of Agriculture. Experts believe Iran could have a much higher share of the global trade of saffron if it pays better attention to branding and marketing of the product.
Due to favorable weather conditions, Iranian saffron is unique in the world. But unfortunately, in many countries, it's smuggled in bulk and is packaged under foreign brands and then sold at higher prices. If we can brand it inside Iran, then we can export it more efficiently.
The young farm owner says his saffron is exported to Europe and the Middle East, despite the restrictions caused by U.S. sanctions on Iran. But more than the U.S. measures, he's concerned about the impact of climate change on saffron cultivation, warning of what he calls saffron immigration from his city, if authorities remain idle.
Unfortunately, saffron is gradually leaving our region and moving to western parts of Iran. This is due to changes in weather conditions and declining rainfall here. If the government helps farmers with modification of planting patterns, we can stop this disaster.
Over the past 2 years, Iran has expanded its cultivation area for saffron to 115,000 hectares, nearly 20 times more than the entire worldwide land dedicated to the crop. While the Iranian red gold is mainly cultivated in the northeastern Khorasan province, other parts of the country, including Khuzestan and Chaharmahal Bakhtiari, are also fertile for saffron farming.
For centuries, saffron has been a key word in Iran's economy, and still is today. Now, Saffron Photography Festival says many know Iran by its red gold, but through the photos shot here, they will get a glimpse of the mesmerizing saffron farms in Iran and how this amazing crop is produced. Yusuf Jalali from the saffron farms in the suburbs of Torbat Haydariya.
Usually, rats are associated with garbage and disease, but these rats are not the typical rodents. They are being trained in Tanzania for search and rescue operations. These are a breed called the African giant pouch rat, which is naturally a very curious creature. It can weigh up to around 1,500 grams and are known to have longer lifespans than other rats. Lead researcher at the Belgium-based non-profit company Apopo, Donna Keane, says this species can live up to 10 years. This means that even after the 9 months of training, the rat will still have a long working career ahead. The size and agility of rats make them invaluable for search and rescue efforts.
So this is where the idea for the rats came in, because the rats are just as trainable as dogs. They've got a great sense of smell, and their small size and natural agility should hopefully make them really good in this scenario, where they could squeeze in small spaces and get closer to any victims.
The rescue rats began training in August last year at the Apopo's Training and Research Center. The rodents are fitted with tiny backpacks that enable real-time wireless audio-visual communication. When they find a potential victim, they pull a small handle hanging around their neck to let the rescue handlers know. The rats were trained to locate humans in mock disaster zones, such as aftermath of earthquakes. Apopo has already trained rats to detect landmines and sift out tuberculosis.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields, like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
So much joy can be found in a bottle of luxury perfume, but parting with hundreds of dollars for such scents, I can take the shine off that experience. Now in Syria, a perfumer is helping people smell expensive without digging too deep into their pockets. One whiff of a fragrance is all a Syrian perfumer needs to recreate the scents of luxury brands for a fraction of a cost. That's very welcome in a country ravaged by years of foreign-backed militancy. Dozens of customers flock daily to his tiny store nestled in the historic bazaar of Damascus. They flash photos on their phones of high-end perfumes they want to replicate. He says all he has is his nose.
Here lies the secret of the profession and the brain power. I started training my nose to smell perfumes since I was 15 years old. I do not own high-end equipment. All I have is my nose, my brain power and expertise. That's all.
In the war-torn country, many people struggle to afford life's bare necessities, let alone perfume. With the local currency losing much of its value, Syrian employees reportedly make roughly $25 a month, on average a quarter of the price of a bottle of imported perfume. This perfumer sells his fragrances for about $6, drawing in a flow of clients from all walks of life. Some people believe the internet will soon make paper books a thing of the past. In Iraq, book lovers are fighting back. They have launched a book festival offering thousands of free books to encourage the Arab nation to read more. The festival is called Iraq Reads. It's attracted big crowds. Iraqis stood shoulder to shoulder behind long tables covered in books and flipped through hundreds of titles to find the one catching their interest. Some others gather on next to the stands to read under a tree, chat about their newest books, or listen to extracts of literature read aloud through a loudspeaker. One of the organizers says they aim to revive the culture of reading books including paper books.
It's a crisis all over the world, not only in Iraq. There is a crisis in terms of reading paper books. One of the goals for our festival is to revive the reading of paper books so that the electronic book does not become an alternative of the paper book.
As part of the festival, 70,000 books have been distributed for free across the country so far. The books covering a wide range of topics were donated by partner libraries. The festival is held in 7 provinces in the Arab country. You have probably seen penny farthings in old books and cartoons, the antique bicycle with one very large and one small wheel. Now, this peculiar bike actually brings fans together in Prague each year to show off their skills. The cyclists were all dressed in historical costumes as they rode in formation at Letno Park in Prague. The traditional one-mile race competition was also held to see who could go the fastest while keeping their balance. The riders, mostly elderly men, said they came there for just the fun of it. Penny farthings were invented around 1870 and were popular until models with two evenly sized wheels and chains were developed. Most bicycles today are based on this design. Egypt is marking 100 years since the discovery of the tomb of Tutankhamun, a pharaoh who ruled more than 1,300 years B.C.
I was fascinated with the story myself, and every morning in which I was here to pick up our inspector when I was working on a dig in the Valley of the Kings, I would wander around the house trying to imagine what it was like if I had been here in 1922 and could have been a part of that. And now here we are, now that it's restored. I do hope that this will turn into a center of cultural interest for anyone and everyone who wants to visit Egypt and wants to hear more of the story about Howard Carter and the king.
In 1922, British Egyptologist Howard Carter and his team discovered Tutankhamun's nearly intact tomb. That was the start of what became a 10-year project to excavate and conserve more than 5,000 unique artifacts. Tutankhamun's reign lasted barely 9 years in the vast span of ancient Egyptian history. Although his successors tried to erase the king's record from history, the valuable discovery of his tomb has immortalized the boy king.
China is taking the final step in the construction of its Tiangong space station, the second permanently inhabited station in low Earth orbit after NASA's International Space Station. The second and last lab component of the station was launched on Monday. The uncrewed module is called Mengtian, which means dreaming of the heavens. The rocket carrying it blasted off from China's Space Launch Center on the coast of the southern island province of Hainan. The 23-ton Mengtian is an advanced lab and does not have space for sleeping and sanitation. Instead, it has more space to carry payloads for scientific studies. Fan Ping is the chief designer of the project. She says this is a special step towards space research.
I think the Mengtian lab module is quite special, as it is for experiment only, which can be seen as a dedicated studio. There are 13 scientific experiment racks in the module and 37 exposed loading stations outside the module, enabling astronauts to do more extravehicular loading experiments in the future.
The Mengtian module is the last building block of the T-shaped Tiangong station. It has to fly 400 kilometers to join the two-module combination already dispatched into space. Together, the three modules will construct the station, which is designed for a lifespan of at least 10 years.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Teachers, railway workers, and public sector employees abandoned their posts recently to protest a planned increase in the retirement age. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. RT noted train services, schools, flights, and scores of businesses in France were disrupted on Thursday, January 19th, as labor unions organized mass protest against President Emmanuel Macron's plans to raise the retirement age to 64, a move bitterly opposed by the French public. The largest marches took place in Paris, where the CGT trade union estimated that 400,000 people took the streets. The union claimed that 2 million protesters marched nationwide, although France's Interior Ministry put the turnout at 1.2 million nationwide and 80,000 in Paris. Amid the demonstrations, police officers clashed with black-clad anarchists who regularly show up at protests in France to spar with police. Video footage showed armored officers using tear gas and batons on the black-clad block and other nearby protesters. Similar demonstrations were held in the cities of Nantes, Lyon, Bordeaux, Marseille, and Toulouse, and in more than 200 other locations across France. France's 8 largest trade unions participated, meaning that schools, railways, airports, power plants, and other vital utilities were operating at a drastically reduced capacity. As few as 1 in 5 high-speed TGV train lines were running, the rail operator, SNCF, said, while Eurostar said that several connections with the UK were cancelled. More than 40% of primary school teachers didn't show up for work, CNN reported, citing the French Education Ministry. Macron's government is urging Parliament to pass a bill that would raise the retirement age for most French workers from 62 to 64, a result that would still see these workers getting their pensions 3 years earlier than most of their European counterparts. While the French government insists that this reform is necessary to stop the country's pension system from sliding into deficit, the unions argue that the system should instead be buoyed by increasing taxes on the wealthy rather than by squeezing more productivity out of aging workers. CGT leader Philippe Martinez told France 24 recently, "It's rare for French unions to all agree on something, so it demonstrates the seriousness of the issue." Macron, who already tried and failed to hike the retirement age in 2019, told reporters that the reform is just and responsible. The public, however, disagrees. A poll taken recently found that 68% of French people are hostile to this pension reform, although only 51% support the union's campaign of protests and strikes. Euronews also wrote in this regard, workers in many French cities took to the streets on Thursday, January 19th, to reject proposed pension changes that would push back the retirement age. Demonstrations gathered thousands of people in the cities of Paris, Marseille, Toulouse, Nantes, Lyon, and more. The strikes have severely disrupted transport, schools, and other public services across France. Under the plans, French workers will have to work longer before receiving a pension under the new rules, with the nominal retirement age rising from 62 to 64. In a country with an aging population and growing life expectancy where everyone receives a state pension, Macron's government says the reform is the only way to keep the system solvent. According to Euronews, unions argue the pension overhaul threatens hard-fought rights and propose a tax on the wealthy or more payroll contributions from employers to finance the pension system. Polls suggest most French people also oppose the reform. More than 200 rallies are expected around France, including a large one in Paris involving all of France's major unions. Laurent Berger, head of the CFDT union, called the government's plans an unfair reform that BFMTV and call on workers to peacefully come to the streets to say they disagree. Police unions opposed to the retirement reform are also taking part in the demonstrations, while those who are on duty are bracing for potential violence if extremist groups join the demonstrations. A majority of trains around France are cancelled, including some international connections, according to the country's rail authority, SNCF. M.E.K. Terrace, Nou Camp.
On March 18, 2013, the Albanian government accepted 210 refugees who had for years been living in Iraq. 210 men and women, all divorced, non-Iraqi, with no children with them. They were all, however, connected to each other through an organization known as the MEK. The MEK was founded by three Iranian university students on the 6th of September 1965. Being influenced by leftist ideologies, the only solution to the emancipation of the Iranian masses, they argued, was armed struggle.